Page versus Dotson, Mr. Daisy.
May it please the court, Bill Daisy, Indiana Federal Community Defenders, representing the appellant Jonathan Dotson. Case is on direct appeal following a 922G conviction and a 10-year sentence. The appeal challenges the legality of a police stop of Mr. Dotson's vehicle, which resulted in a search, seizure of a weapon, and statements made by Mr. Dotson. The argument proceeds focusing on two bases that the district court looked at in justifying the search. One being that Mr. Dotson could have been arrested for disorderly conduct by a police officer, thereby justifying the later stop of the vehicle. The other basis, though to a lesser extent, is a statement by a bystander, unidentified bystander, that Mr. Dotson had a gun. Just to be clear, though,
this anonymous tip was, the person said it directly to the officer, right?
He did.
Face-to-face exchange.
Yes.
And this was someone who was right there at the scene.
Yes. Exactly. Factually, Officer Butler is cruising Indianapolis. He comes upon the area of 30th and Graceland. He sees 5 to 6 people, largely in the street. Mr. Dotson is in the middle of the street, separated by 5 to 6 feet from a female with whom he appears to be arguing. There is a female, in the officer's words, is pushing him away from the other female. He stops. He says, "Knock it off." The crowd disperses, crowd being everyone except the guy on the sidewalk to whom the officer had his subsequent discussion. Mr. Dotson, among those who obeyed the "knock it off" comment, got in his car and drove away. What that officer saw, step one, is in our argument, was not the crime of disorderly conduct. There was an argument that he did not see blows exchanged, he did not see a struggle, he did not describe the content of what speech he might have overheard. What he observed, he observed. He, of course, at that time, made no effort to stop or interrogate either Mr. Dotson or anyone else. He said, "Knock it off," and they knocked it off and left. This person that he saw on the street, we argue, is the functional equivalent of the anonymous phone call in the JL case.
Except the police officer was able to eyeball him and make certain judgments with respect to whether he thought what he provided was accurate or not.
But what those judgments might have been are not reflected on the record.
They aren't, but the other thing about looking a person face-to-face is presumably the officer might have been able to identify that person at a later time, follow up. I mean, the Supreme Court in JL, I think, takes some care to make it clear that an anonymous telephone call is, I suppose an anonymous email might be the same, but I mean, things that really bear no indicia, no external way of checking up on them, like the telephone call, are quite different from this personal encounter.
True. And Justice Kennedy, concurring in the
right.
JL opinion,
particularly
with whom the Chief Justice joined, posits this question, you know, could a judge consider a statement by a person who drives up in a car, which the officer later describes, who reports a crime has been committed?
Well, for one thing, you know, the person who's standing there, the officer knows that in our case, that the person who gives him the tip about the gun was just with Mr. Dotson. The telephone call person could be calling from Alaska. You know, we don't know where that person is.
There was a factor.
A person would be less prone to make a false accusation face to face because if it were shown to be false, he could get into trouble, and the policeman knows who he is. So,
well, here the policeman doesn't know who he is.
Well,
but
he's seen him. We may see him again.
The court's correct in this respect. How does the guy who's making that statement know that he is anonymous? How does he know he isn't going to be detained for the future? Possession of a gun isn't a crime, though. Period. And I'd like to point that out. There is a factor.
What difference does that make? I don't understand.
He's not reporting a crime. I can
so
possess
what?
A gun.
So what? I don't understand you. He's providing information, and if it's false, he knows he can get into trouble.
If If it's true, and that was a trustworthy statement, that person has a gun.
I mean, look, he's not saying to the policeman that that person is wearing a carnation in his buttonhole. He's obviously saying that because this is something that might concern the police. In other words, might be criminal activity. Otherwise, there's no motive to say that.
Nothing from that statement implies it was criminal activity. I mean, I'll say that. There's a factor in the JL case that's not present here, which is if it were true that the anonymous tip were true, which is that young man standing at the station had a gun. That young man was 15 years old. Presumably a police can look at him and tell he's under 18, which means he can't possess a gun, or under 21, which means you can't have a concealed weapon. If the guy had a gun, it could have been a crime.
What point are you trying to make? The point is that in these circumstances, with this disorderly conduct, the possession of a gun is something that is of interest to the police and is going to lead to some further police activity, which may result in an arrest. And the person giving the police this information knows this and knows that if he's lying, he can get into trouble.
I guess the point I'm trying to
police
make is...
Police don't like being sent on wild goose chases by wise guys and troublemakers, right? So there's more likelihood that he's telling the truth than if he were just telephoning.
My point is possession of a gun is not unlawful.
I think you keep saying that, but what does that have to do with anything in this case?
I guess rhetorically I would ask, why can a police...
Don't ask rhetorically. What does this have to do with anything? Why is he telling this to the police? Because the police are interested. It's perfectly clear this man who's just left the scene of some disorderly conduct, if it's discovered that he has a gun, he's likely to be arrested or at least stopped. The bystander who tells the police officer this knows that this is quite likely to result in the stop or the arrest of this person.
Right, and let's just imagine that at the counterfactual, suppose the police officer had been walking past a peaceful little family picnic along Lake Michigan. If somebody said, oh, by the way, you know, one person here has a gun, maybe the police wouldn't worry about it at all if otherwise it's lawful to carry guns in that jurisdiction. This was a tense situation where people were about to, you know, where at least the perception was there was a disorderly and potentially violent situation. So in that context, having a gun might make the police think, gee, we better look into this to make sure the guy doesn't turn around, drive back, and pull out his gun.
And then it's a domestic, he says it's a domestic incident. And certainly we're all aware, and the police officers are aware, of how that can turn into violence. The only way this thing got broken up was because the police were there. So certainly there was an interest that the police had to track him down and at least question him.
I would point out that the statement wasn't, he carried the gun, he displayed the gun, he brandished the gun, I saw the gun.
But he said it was a domestic dispute.
He did say
right,
that.
Right? And that's what I'm saying, domestic dispute. I mean, knowing how those incidents often turn to violence, I think creates a problem for you.
Again, perhaps it's a failure of questions of proof as much as anything. But the record is absent anything from which the officer or reviewing court could conclude that this fellow, by his demeanor or otherwise, was conveying information about something he saw rather than something he heard, something that he knew already from a fact, and certainly absent.
Well, if he knew it, he knew it. So what difference does it make how he knew it?
Again, I suppose the officer's credibility determination of what he just heard and whether it rose to the level that would justify a Terry-type stop. I would reserve with the court's leave what moments I may have left for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Daisy.
Mr. Massa?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Mark Massa. I represented the United States in the trial of this cause as I continue to do this morning. The district court's factual conclusions in this case are not in dispute. Its legal argument is well-grounded, and we respectfully ask that it be affirmed in all regards. The court weighed the totality of the circumstances and found reasonable suspicion and indeed probable cause for the stop of Mr. Dotson. And as the court has noted this morning, the main argument would appear to be in this appeal that the officer stopped Dotson based solely on an anonymous tip and that the case left us on all fours with Florida versus JL. I would submit that that is not a fair reading of the facts. And indeed, the district court, in both its preliminary entry and subsequent order following the motion, specifically distinguished Florida versus JL in its ruling, noting that the officers had far more here than an anonymous tip. Sergeant Butler had probable cause that Dotson had committed the misdemeanor of disorderly conduct in his presence based on his own observations. And he subsequently learned from an eyewitness that Dotson was armed. Now, it is also worth noting to the court this morning that Judge Tinder, in his preliminary order, which was recently provided to the court in the supplemental appendix on page 14 in footnote 2, makes the point that the court did not rely on this piece of information in making its judgment of reasonable suspicion. But be that as it may, the court has noted this morning that this witness who spoke to Sergeant Butler did not enjoy the same sort of cloak of anonymity that we've seen in the anonymous phone call conversations. We had a face-to-face conversation with a police officer, and it's a fair inference that only the exigencies of the moment, the fact that the officer left immediately to go provide backup in the pursuit and an arrest of a presumably armed suspect, I think it's a fair inference that only those exigencies prevented him from getting identifying information from this witness in the first place. There's also flight at the sight of an officer under Illinois v. Wardlow. That can provide reasonable suspicion.
Well, why is that probative if the officer told him to break it up, though? That really is heads I win, tails you lose. Break it up and go away so he goes away, and then you say, oh, got you, Illinois against Wardlow, you left. I mean, maybe we don't place any weight on the fact that he left.
A fair point. Although I would argue that observation, it's somewhat unclear from the record, but it's my recollection that observation occurred either contemporaneously or right after the witness at the scene told him that he has a gun, which could again inform the officer's judgment that a man with a gun who's just been in a disturbance, which I would also correct with the counsel's characterization of the fact. I think there is evidence in the record that Sergeant Butler observed people in physical contact, including the defendant and a woman who was trying to get away from him, and he was being restrained. So there was certainly a disturbance that he observed. If the court has, mm-hmm. has no further questions, the government would rest on its brief.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Monster. Mr. Daisy, how much time does he have? 1 minute? Any further? Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not? Well, we thank you for accepting the appointment. Next case for argument is United